Welcome to I Am My Passion Project, a Woman House production. I'm Lorna Nickel. I'm an artist, writer, graphic designer, thinker, a Renaissance woman, if you will. This podcast is a feminist platform to discuss sexism, health, and wellness, redefining beauty, and healing from betrayal trauma. Each season has a theme. The theme for season two is women redesigning the world as a better and safer place for women. And here's the cool thing about the fight for gender equality. Men can help us with this. And when we all come up with solutions together, it makes a better world for everyone. So grab a big old mug of Fight the Patriarchy tea, settle into your woman house, and let's start reimagining a world where women are made visible and empowered to become their own passion projects. Belinda Clemenson is the author of the book, Women, Leadership, and Saving the World: Why Everything Gets Better When Women Lead, and the founder and CEO of Women's Leadership Intensive, an organization that inspires, empowers, supports, and equips women to lead the change the world needs. She received the Gold Canada Award for Excellence in Training and is a certified professional coach, training provider, and member of the International Coaching Federation. With over 25 years of leadership development experience, she helps women leaders step into their potential and connect to a place of purpose where their unique strengths can serve to make organizations and communities better. I asked Belinda to be a guest on this season of I Am My Passion Project because I admire the work she's doing to make the world a better place for women. She is not only educating on the topic of gender inequality through valuable research and insights into these issues, but she is also doing the work to help train the next generation of women leaders. Belinda, welcome to the podcast. Now let's uproot the status quo, shall we?
Let's do it. Thanks for having me, Lorna.
What brought you to the work of coaching women to be leaders, and why is it so important to you?
I have been doing leadership development for my whole career, pretty much. And for a long time, I did sort of more general leadership development, you know, had mixed gender groups in the room. I've always loved my work. I'm very passionate about leadership development and people development, both the intrapersonal, right, the us with ourselves, and the interpersonal dynamics that happen. And because we spend so much of our lives at work, that seems like the right place for me to go and do my work as well. So I did that for a very long time. And for a long time, even though I could see that there were inequalities and there were different expectations based on gender happening and different roles based on gender, I sort of told myself that wasn't really my job. My job was to help everybody be a better leader. My client was the organization that was hiring me, and my job was kind of work with the people in the room and do my best by those people, which I did. And telling myself that worked for a long time until it didn't anymore. So I would say about a decade ago, I had a crisis of consciousness where I had to ask myself some hard questions. Am I actually upholding the status quo because I'm supporting, without getting into the more social and gendered issues that I'm seeing? Those aren't part of my mandate necessarily when I'm hired, right? In that old leadership development model. So do I have area permission to go there? If I don't go there, am I leaving something on the table? Am I part of the problem, basically? And so it sort of unraveled an entire career for me to start asking myself those questions and to ask, am I actually being part of the problem or part of the solution? Over a few years of unraveling, I started to then realize that what I was doing was not sustainable for me any longer because I didn't feel like I was in integrity. And I did see all of the inequalities playing out. I saw that it was the same cast of characters consistently being the CEO or being the executive leadership team. I saw the roles of women even in those executive rooms. So that's where I had to make a big decision to sort of leave that practice behind and start down this road of women's leadership specifically and gender equity work. I did try to avoid doing gender equity work at first. I thought, I'm a leadership development professional. Stay in your lane, Belinda. Just do the work and keep yourself contained. But it's impossible, right? As soon as we start doing work around issues of equality and equity and justice, you can't put a false boundary on that and say, well, only talk about it in this way, because it all fits together into an entire system. In the last few years, I've really embraced the gender equity advocacy side of this work as well. I don't just do leadership development, although I love that work. I can't do leadership development for women without doing the gender equity advocacy work. They have to go together.
Can you talk a little bit about what was holding you back from doing that? Because I know that even just the idea of having to deal with feminist issues can be scary for people, men and women, to dive into or even face in any part of their lives. Was that something that you were thinking of as a fear for you, thinking of maybe alienating some people that you were working with or friends?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think as soon as you unapologetically declare yourself as a feminist, as soon as you say that you are working for gender equity, as soon as you do that, to a certain extent, you are opening yourself up to criticism in a way that you're not when you're towing the line and maintaining the status quo. And that is a tool of the patriarchy. It is a tool of the status quo to keep everybody in line and quiet, right? And following along and doing what we've always been expected to do. There definitely is backlash when we start to step outside of those boundaries and to push against the systems. When we push on those systems push back on us. Mm-hmm. And so that was definitely a big part of my fear. Will I lose clients? Which, you know, I have to earn a living, right? So will I be able to earn a living? And I have to say, the beginning of this transition of going from more traditional leadership development into women's leadership specifically were some lean years. I mean, I started doing this work at a time when I would talk to organizations who would say to me, like, women's leadership problem. Like, I don't think we have a women's leadership problem. And this is a decade ago. Now, most of the clients I talk to recognize they have a women in leadership problem. They're still not necessarily investing and fixing it, but at least we can have a conversation now.
Yeah. Opening up the doors to conversation is important. So in your book, you pose the question, why is it that we value the perspective of the middle-aged white cis man more than anyone else's perspective? Yes, why is that?
Well, colonialism, patriarchy, to a certain extent, the widespread movement of the Christian church into various different cultures around the world, which was part of the colonial history that we share here in North America. You know, if you go far enough back in history, we actually see more gender equality. Go far enough back in history, we see sort of a balance of matriarchy and patriarchy in the world. But when you move into systems where we start to commoditize things and we want to make sure that people own things and we start to consolidate power in the hands of some people and not other people, that's, I think, where some of those systems start to get quite corrupted. And so we are now still living the legacy of a colonial and patriarchal history. I think what that means is there is still a long lineage of those types of men being in leadership positions. We continue to elect them. They are the absolute majority of CEOs and decision makers in the world. We continue to promote them. We continue to assume that they are competent and credible for every job. And so I think there's a sort of unexamined positive bias towards those types of men being leaders.
Right.
And so we're still valuing those opinions and perspectives. And for the most part, that is still the cluster of folks who are making most of the decisions in our societies.
Yeah. And we are coming upon the election season again.
Yes, we are.
And the US doesn't have a great history for having anyone except for men in the presidential role. So I feel like it's one of those things where when people see the leadership as being men and primarily white cis men, it just makes people feel like that is the status quo. And why diverge from that when it seems like the safest route to go?
Absolutely. And that's on people's radars with the upcoming election in the US. But you see, like, that's your choice. You're choosing between one white, cis, middle-aged or older male and another, right? And so those are the kinds of choices that you have. Same here in Canada, where I live. Our candidates for the upcoming prime minister election look very similar to that, right? Those are our choices. And it's not a very diverse slate of candidates from the ground up. And when we do see that diverse candidates, including women, put themselves forward into those roles, they are subjected to incredible questioning of their credentials. Are they only in that job because they are a woman or because they represent some other dimension of diversity? Threats of violence for women in particular, threats of sexual violence and violence against women's families, which is a very gendered type of violence that is applied specifically to women. And so the barriers for participation in some of these spheres are very high and very challenging to overcome.
So on that subject of women in power positions actually getting a backlash from the patriarchy in violent ways, I just read an article in the New York Times today, actually. It was from last Sunday's paper, but I read the article today about deep fakes and sexual exploitation using deep fakes and how women are unfortunately having to deal with that on top of the challenges that they already face in trying to overcome the inequalities that they have. Reading that article was just so painful to me, and that there really aren't any safeguards in line right now for women who have had deep fakes done of them. It's just another one of those added pain points for women trying to gain equality or equity. Like, how is that supposed to happen?
Absolutely. And any leadership role is inherently public. Even if you're a leadership role within an organization or a corporation, you may not be as public as someone who's in a leadership role in the entertainment industry or in politics, but you are still seen by a lot more people when you go into any kind of leadership role. You're more visible. You know, as soon as you put yourself in that position of being visible or being public, there is an inherent vulnerability that goes along with it. And there are so many strategies and tactics to basically enact various types of violence, whether that's character assassination, whether that's something like deep fakes, like you're talking about, whether that's criticism being held to a very different standard, a much higher standard than anyone else, or actual violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Verbal abuse, abuse online. You know, we're asking women to step into leadership roles. And in fact, I would argue and do argue in the book that we need women in leadership roles, because when we are in those roles, we actually make a positive difference across every metric that you can think of. However, we're almost asking women to have to be superhuman to put themselves in a position where that kind of thing might then happen for them.
Right.
Right. And these could be microaggressions or macroaggressions.
Mm-hmm.
For sure, every woman out there in a leadership role is experiencing microaggressions, compounded by intersecting identities, mm-hmm. of course. And then the more public you get, the aggressions increase in scale alongside that.
Yeah.
Right? Look at Hillary Clinton when she ran for president. Look at deep fakes with Taylor Swift, who's making a positive difference in the world economically as well as socially
mm-hmm.
at the moment. Right? So it's like people will try to take you down.
Yep. Well, men will try to take you down and do it in like the most
Absolutely.
Egregious sexist ways they can think of.
Yeah. Men and those who have internalized
right.
the patriarchal systems, right? Because women have internalized those systems too, because we grew up in the patriarchy. We grew up in this colonial patriarchal kind of society. And so if we don't do the work of examining that in ourselves and starting to make sure that we're questioning those assumptions that we were raised with, then we can become a tool of the patriarchy too, which
right.
is sort of like a double betrayal in a way.
And that's one of the things that I talked about last season with Gail Dines when we were talking about female self-objectification and how that becomes a big problem with going about your daily life. And also when you're trying to achieve greater status in your career, when you're trying to move yourself forward, if you're continually objectifying yourself and other women, it's just a losing battle.
Absolutely. And we train young girls to start doing that from
right.
the get-go. The media teaches young girls to self-objectify right out of the gate.
Yeah. The other thing about the article that I read about the deep fakes was that Google is actually one of the problems with why you can find them, why they are so easily accessible, because you can do a search on Google and that content will come up. Google, like many other giant organizations, is male-dominated for their infrastructure of leadership. This is one of the things that I haven't researched yet, but my belief, if I do the research, is that I will probably see that women-owned companies or companies where there is a large collection of women in the leadership roles wouldn't be allowing things like that to happen through their company. Once they saw something in their company that was that hurtful to women, they would make the changes necessary. Whereas Google right now won't take the steps to make any changes?
There's a couple of things there. I mean, absolutely, the research would say that when women are in leadership roles, things like ethical decision-making, inclusive decision-making, multi-stakeholder focus that looks at not just sort of shareholder as stakeholder, but community, employee, environment, social, et cetera, all of those sort of broader, more circular stakeholder viewpoints, which means that women leaders tend to make decisions that are better for not just the bottom line, but also all of those other communities of stakeholders. So the research would support what you're saying very much. I think the other thing, in addition to that, is whose comfort are we prioritizing in these situations? I think there's a lot of pushback on things like DEI initiatives because they make some people uncomfortable, or they have made some people uncomfortable. And my question is, why are we so concerned about the comfort of some people and so completely unconcerned about the comfort of others? I'll give you an example of this. I was doing a book club, a women's book club, about my book. And one of the women started talking about how concerned she was that with the rise of feminism and gender equality, that her son would not be able to have access to job opportunities.
Wow.
And I've heard this many times, right? We're worried that we're going to take opportunities away mm-hmm. from straight, young, privileged, white, in this case, men. And so my challenge there, or my way of responding to that, is to say that is a theoretical example of discrimination. We actually don't see examples of that in the data. We're not seeing that men are not getting jobs. We're not seeing that those men are not being hired or promoted. Actually, we're seeing that happen pretty much at the same rate we always have, maybe very slight differences in certain industries. So there's no evidence to support that theoretical discrimination against these young men is actually happening. But we're more worried about that than we are about the very real discrimination that is being experienced and can be documented in research and with data, the discrimination that your daughters are experiencing
mm-hmm.
every single day when they go to school, when they go to work. So why do we care so much about the comfort, the theoretical threat to comfort for these men, where we're very, very okay with young girls, women of all ages, being very uncomfortable across the board, to the point where we're okay with paying them less money, we're okay with them being harassed at school and work, we're okay with them feeling unsafe walking down the street. We're good with that level of discomfort. But if we even hint that some of these men might get uncomfortable from time to time because we're changing the social systems and starting to be more honest about what's happening,
mm-hmm.
then there's an uproar, even from women.
Yeah, that can be so frustrating. As a woman in a role that I've created for myself, where I'm trying to educate women about inequality. And I see a lot of people that just don't want to be educated. They just don't want it. They're more comfortable not seeing it. And I can understand that, because once you see it, you can't unsee it. And that's the position Yes. that I'm in right now. I have seen it and I can't unsee it, and I can't not do something that's in my power to move us in a more positive direction.
Yeah.
I would like to lead into the question of, what is the difference do you see between equity and equality? You talk about that a little bit in your book. So I was wondering if you could just say something here.
Yeah, it's an important distinction. And I agree with you. I think I'm in the same boat, that I can't unsee it. And so here we go down the down this path, right? It's the irrevocable path. We can't change it. We're here now. We're not going anywhere else. I think the difference between equality and equity is an important one, because equality assumes that everybody should get the same thing. You know, if everybody needs to get from A to B, everybody should get a bicycle. And not only that, it should be the same bicycle, and that's fair. Now, the question is, who determines what that thing should be? What's the default position that says, well, to get from A to B, it should be a bike? If you're talking to somebody else, they might say, well, actually, the best thing would be a wheelchair. Or somebody else might say it's a bus, or somebody else might say it's a car, or somebody else would say it's your feet. So who determines what that thing is that we should all get in equality? And the answer is that the default is always the male default in our society, right? So for what works for men is considered universal.
Right.
That's right down to the temperature in an office building, the size of the chair you're sitting in, how big the steering wheel is in your car, how big your phone is. All of those defaults are based on things that work for the standard male norm, which of course that doesn't even exist because there's so much diversity around among males, right? So the issue with equality is that we're trying to create a universal norm that will work for everybody. But because we know that human beings are diverse across the board, of course, a universal norm is not going to work equally well for everyone. So when we start to look at equity, that's where we say we need to be able to provide people with the same opportunities to be successful and to thrive in whatever setting or system they're in. And that might look very different for me than it does for you, because we're coming from different perspectives, different life experiences, different intersectional identities, and all of those factors play a role in what do I need when I show up at work. An example of this is we see as women are more and more equal numbers in the workforce, I think we're somewhere just over 48% right now of the workforce, the demand for flexible work becomes even more important, because women's role in caretaking and emotional labor still outweighs the demands for that for men. Now it's getting better. It's going in the right direction, but still women bear the burden of most of that caregiving and emotional labor work that happens. And so the demand for flexibility in the workplace is largely driven by women, because we have children to look after. We have aging parents to look after. We have community members that require our care. However, when we look at something like that, that's saying, okay, flexibility is inherently about equity, because it's saying you might need this, somebody else might need something different, and that's great. And so when we get into those situations, what we find is that it's better for women, but it's also better for everyone, because more and more men are valuing flexibility as well, whether that's for caregiving responsibilities because they want to participate more in childcare than they used to in previous generations, or they just want to not be identifying only as the worker or the employee. Mm-hmm. They want to have a more well-rounded life and experience of life. When we get into conversations of equity, it's inherently more complex. And if we can't handle complexity, we will never achieve equity, because we have to be able to say there's so much diversity that we have to be able to consider these conversations and learn from each other about what is needed to make it so that everyone can thrive. Not easy.
No, not easy. Complicated.
Yes.
And so I can see why a lot of companies would like to steer clear of having to deal with that, because it's easier.
Yeah, exactly. Equality, still not easy, but much easier than equity.
So why is diversity, equity, and inclusion in the management structure important for a healthy society?
Up until very recently, diversity, equity, inclusion was sort of seen as something that happened on the side, right? So it's like, well, our main business is building widgets, but because diversity, equity, inclusion is a topic right now, we'll spend some time on it over here on the side of our desks. Mm-hmm. And usually it's women and other equity deserving groups that are doing most of that side of the desk work. And most of the time they're not paid.
Right.
So that's great. We'll keep them busy over there trying to solve the problem that they didn't create. We won't pay them to do that work, but we'll get it happening. And then we can check some boxes and we can maybe report that we're doing this. Maybe we can apply for some DEI awards. I see a lot of that happening. The issue with that is that it never becomes integral to the actual business of building widgets or whatever it is that your company does. And so finally, we're just starting, I think, to crest the wave of people saying like, no, anywhere that your business strategy includes human beings, then diversity is fundamentally in the mix. I can't think of any other way of looking at this, right? Like, of course, diversity is in the mix. Wherever your business strategy bumps up against humans, whether that's employees or customers or any other communities of operation, you name it, diversity, equity, inclusion has to be integrated into your business strategy, because your customers are diverse, because your employees are diverse. And so I think the sort of illusion that we could do this as a side project hopefully is starting to fade. And people are saying, no, like this is in the fabric. Diversity is a fact. We didn't just make this up in the last decade, like, oh, all of a sudden we have diversity. No, we've had diversity always, right? We're just starting to now acknowledge it and try to change the social systems to make it more equal and equitable and inclusive for the diverse people that exist.
So that kind of brings me to the topic of women who are put in leadership roles who have no support. So I wondered if you could talk about how important it is for women who are put in leadership roles to actually have the support that they need to do the work that they were hired to, instead of just being put in a position as, say, like the token Black woman. I'm putting that in air quotes.
This is essentially why we started the Women's Leadership Intensive, to create leadership development experiences by women for women, because that didn't really exist. we call leadership development gender neutral, but it's not. It's based on the male leadership experience and the male leadership career journey. And so a lot of times what happens is that women in leadership roles are very isolated. As you said, they might be the only one or one of a handful. They're put in positions where they often have to defend their credibility in order to keep those jobs. They're usually held to a higher standard of performance, both interpersonally and in terms of whatever technical role they have. And so that whole combination of things makes it extremely challenging to be in those positions and isolating and lonely.
Yeah.
There's this phenomenon called the glass cliff, where often women are put in leadership roles when there's a high chance of failure. Then when they do fail, as anybody would fail being put into that position, you know, we can sort of say, oh, well, you know, see, she wasn't qualified after all, you know, go back to hiring the old guys we're used to hiring. I think some of the key pieces that are really important for women in leadership positions, number one is actual support from other women leaders who understand the spot you're in. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially one of the things that we provide in our programs, because it is so refreshing to show up in a room where you can share your story or your experience and everyone else in there goes, yep, I know what you're talking about, right? There is no gaslighting. There's no dismissing. There's no minimizing. There's this sense of understanding of like, I know what you're talking about. And that is critical. Because we start to doubt ourselves after a while, right? If everybody is always telling us, don't worry about it, it's just a little thing, P didn't mean it that way, right? We start to believe it and wonder, like, am I too sensitive? Am I not cut out for this job? So having that support of other women leaders who get it, that is critical. And then the other piece is really being able to take the time to develop your own leadership values. Why are you even there? It's a lot of work to be in these jobs. What are you trying to accomplish? What matters to you about doing this job? I mean, sure, paycheck, great, whatever. But most women in leadership roles actually have a bigger sense of values and purpose that they're trying to align with. So that's a powerful motivator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you talk about some workplace policies that you believe need to change to make women's leadership more equitable?
First of all, pay transparency and pay equity reviews. That's just structural stuff, right? Every organization knows what you're paying people. That data exists. Let's be honest about it. A great example, we do a lot of work in the mining industry because it's a very male-dominated industry. We've got a lot of very isolated women leaders who come to our course. And so there is a mining company that set this gender equity target. They wanted to be at gender parity by 2030. And so they started doing pay equity reviews to say, like, so of the women we have, are we paying them equally? Mm-hmm. And through that pay equity review process, they found 6,000 situations where they were underpaying women just because they're women.
Wow.
6,000. And that's just one strategy, right? So do a pay equity review, first of all. Yep. Every company can and should do that. And then the next thing is implement flexible work, because that's where we're headed. There's no sort of denying we're on our way there. And then also have a real focus on your code of conduct and your respect in the workplace policies, and not just in name only. So a lot of organizations have those policies, but they don't do anything when those policies are violated. It's this day-to-day interactions. Culture is behavior at scale. It's not what we say. It's not what's written in the policy. It's what people do every day. And so if you are managing disrespectful behaviors, and that's part of your overall day-to-day management and leadership function, then you can start to create a more respectful culture, which is by default a more inclusive culture. And then I would say the other thing is look at your leadership demographics and correct it where you have a problem. So there's a lot of places on a leadership journey where we can see these gaps. A lot of times it's early in the leadership pipeline. So getting into that first leadership job, that tends to be a bottleneck for women. And then also getting into the top jobs is another bottleneck for women. So where you see those bottlenecks in your data, fix it.
Yeah. Fix it.
Fix it. It's easy. The argument that we don't have qualified women, you know, our numbers of women graduating from college and university programs would really debunk that. They may not have as much experience because they've been excluded for so long. That's okay. Experience can be gained.
Well, there are plenty of other men who have gotten jobs that have not enough qualifications either, just because they were men and they were white and they were there.
Absolutely. And we can name some pretty high top jobs right now where that is the case. Right? With zero experience. Zero.
Yeah. Yes, we can. But we won't, because we're not going to talk about politics anymore. What are some hurdles that hold women back from stepping into leadership roles today? And what are two or three tools that women can use to overcome those hurdles?
When women come to our leadership programs, we always ask them, you know, what are the top three things you want to be walking away with? And confidence is always top of the list. Mm. The lack of confidence is systemic. It's not personal. So I think that is one of the hurdles, is that we've often sort of individualized this problem of confidence for women, right? Saying that you personally need to work on yourself and raise your self-confidence. The question that I would ask is, why is this so universally true for so many women that we have a confidence problem, that we don't feel confident?
Right.
I wonder why we don't feel that way. And so I think that's the kinds of questions that we need to be asking. Again, if we sort of look at the progression of women in leadership, for a while it was, let's fix the women so they can come and lead in our company. Let's, you know, make them more confident and more assertive and better negotiators or whatever things we need to do. Then they did that and the women still aren't able to thrive because they didn't change the culture and they didn't change the system and they didn't do any of the other structural things. I think that these hurdles are all really integrated. You know, we can't just take one of them in isolation and say, well, let's work on women's confidence, but not work on the systems that teach women that they actually don't belong here. We don't believe them. They're not credible. We don't think they're competent. Like, no wonder women have a confidence problem. There's no representation. There's very few examples. There's all kinds of reasons. It's really the system, I think, that puts up a lot of those hurdles. And then if we individualize it, we're never going to fix the system. We're going to keep women very busy trying to get better and better and better, which, I mean, personal professional growth, I'm all for it. But at a certain point, it's time to change the systems. We shouldn't have to work twice as hard to get half as far.
So I think what I'm hearing you say is that at this point in time, the onus should really be on men to step up and acknowledge the things that they've been doing to hold women back and make the changes themselves.
Yeah. I think we need to, again, start looking at this with clearer eyes. I do this all the time. Organization wants me to come and work with them. I go on their website and I look at the picture of all their members of their board and their executive leadership team. Take a wild guess what they all look like.
Old white men.
Right? Exactly. And so I can no longer sort of say to people, like, I hold up that picture and say, like, you tell me what the problem is. We can't keep pretending that that's meritocracy. Because if we're saying that that's meritocracy, then we're actually saying that we think those middle-aged and older white cis men are smarter than the rest of us, are better than the rest of us. That's why they have those jobs. And I fundamentally disagree.
So what is the solution, Melinda? What is the solution? What's going to fix this?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, some days, honestly, I feel like I am banging my head against a wall.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're never going to change. And so other days I have conversations with people and I feel like things are changing, but it's still so slow. I have a lot of faith in younger generations. And I don't mean this in that I think the older generations, like myself, should abdicate our role and responsibility. Those of us in older generations have money, we have resources, we have assets, we have job titles, we have all kinds of things that we can mobilize to make change. We're, for the most part, safe. We're not just starting our careers and trying to buy our first home or get our first job or whatever it is. So I think we have a role to play. That being said, I do think that younger generations are growing up in an environment where we're talking about gender. We are talking about equity. We are having these conversations much more openly and much more honestly than I think previous generations have ever done. So I'm hoping that that is going to build momentum. And I think there's generations of younger people who are not going to take it anymore. We're seeing this in things like labor shortages in certain industries. If those young folks are looking at an industry and they're saying, like, it's not equitable, it's not inclusive, it's not environmentally sound, right? If they're looking at all these sort of social aspects of an organization and they're saying, no, we're not working for you. And I think that is the kind of thing that will start to force some change. For example, again, if I look at our mining clients, if we've historically excluded women from all of those jobs, and those are great jobs, especially in places like the US and Canada, right? Mining jobs are really good jobs with great pay. So if we're excluding women from all those jobs, then you're excluding 50% of the talent pool. And it is not easy to attract young people into the mining industry, right? It's got a bad reputation. It's demanding. And if you're going into a culture that's not inclusive and is abusive, yeah, you're not getting millennials in there. You're not getting Gen Zs in there. So I think the pain points are going to start to pile up.
And my hope too is that society will just realize that it's incredibly important to include women in the conversation and allowing us to take action, because we do have 50% of the ideas, 50% of the education and the knowledge and the experience and stuff. And when you exclude that, you're just looking at a world that's going to be lacking.
Exactly. It does not make sense. Women are a huge untapped resource in the world.
Yeah.
And honestly, based on all the research that I've looked at and that I've done, the closer we get to equal participation of all genders in decision making, the better decisions we're going to make and the better chance we have of tackling some of these big social challenges that we're all facing, like climate crisis and income disparity, rich and poor, the gaps between rich and poor are growing all around the world. We've got some big social problems to work on. And so it doesn't make any sense to have 50% of the population not participating in solving them.
Well said. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Before we end this episode, I would like you to share with the listeners, if you have any upcoming workshops that you're doing or ways that they can reach out to you or learn more about this topic.
So definitely head to our website, womensleadershipintensive.ca, which is potentially the longest website address in Canada where I live. So womensleadershipintensive.ca. We have an upcoming session. We do a women leading sustainability session, which looks at how women are leading in the sustainability and ESG and climate crisis space. That's an open enrollment workshop that anyone can attend. And then we've also got our other leadership development programs. Our year-long intensive is open enrollment as well. And we've got women from all over the world who join us for that program. I think in our course right now, we've got Australia, Mexico, the US, Canada, and Finland represented in our program at the moment. So it's a really awesome community that we build. And then of course, on the website too, there's a book page. If that's a good starting point for you, just to start to do some learning and research on your own, then the book is a great place to start.
Yes, the book is a great place to start. I'm enjoying it right now. I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be on my podcast. And I know I reached out to you like months and months ago and you were on, you know, my big wish list. I was like, oh, that would be so amazing if I could get her on the podcast. And here you are. So thanks so much for taking a chance on me.
You're so welcome. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Am My Passion Project. Regular episodes drop every Thursday, like biscuits, with bonus episodes sprinkled into the week. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider sharing it with friends or leaving a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, I invite you to use Woman House as your muse to help redesign our world as a better and safer place for women.
I am my passion project.